This is the Medic Cast, July 30th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 77. I'm Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to welcome you to this podcast. If you're a brand new listener of the show, welcome to the Medicast. I hope you take an opportunity to head on over to the Medicast website at medicast.com. Check out all of the information over there. The show notes for tonight's episode will have links to everything I talk about, as well as over at the website, you can find all kinds of information on topics, tips and tricks, and medications I've covered in the past, as well as the ability to search for other topics that I've blogged about outside of the podcast. And of course, for all of you long-term listeners, thank you for contributing to the show, and thank you for all of your questions, comments, suggestions, and corrections for the episodes. It's really what makes the Medicast a community effort that we can pull together and provide information to each other that is something we all want to hear about. So keep those comments and questions and corrections, of course, coming in. There's been some good emails that I've received from listeners this week, and I want to make sure I give them plenty of attention. So I'll lead off with an email from listener David, who sent me an email on a story that I have been following in the news that has to do with the pending strike of employees of the American Medical Response Corporation that provides 911 and interfacility transport services in 40 communities throughout the northeastern United States. Primarily, the employees involved are involved in Maine, New Hampshire, and eastern Massachusetts. And this you know, brings to light again the fact that we are among the lowest paid medical professionals when you look at the services, level of care, and equipment that we carry and are expected to know how to operate. We make far less than our counterparts in other healthcare services that have similar or less than the same level of care and training. So hopefully we can spin this story in light and raise light of the fact that, you know, there are people out there who are respiratory therapists, who are LPNs or RNs, and have huge amount of training and respect in the community, medical community, in their own right. And that certainly we in EMS as BLS and especially ALS providers, with the number of qualifications and procedures and things that we are qualified to perform in the field, certainly should be receiving similar recognition for our services. So, David, thanks for sending me that link to that article. It's definitely something we all should be paying attention to. Hopefully, these members of the EMS service get the recognition that they deserve for the services that they provide. The next email I got came from listener Woody, and he's been listening to the show for some time, and thank you very much, Woody, for your compliments. He's a college student and recently received ALS certification. Congratulations. And he had a couple of questions. One was that he was wondering if I knew of any websites that would help quiz him on different cardiac rhythms. And Woody, I got your email right before I went to record, so I'll tell you what, I will find something in the next week or so and post it up on the website as a blog post. So check in at medicast.com and I'll see if I can find some websites I think might be of help to anybody that wants a little practice reading cardiac rhythms. The second question he has, I think, is something that everybody should be checking with their own training and protocol officer about, and it has to do with training for AED use. There was he asked a question first about Medtronix. Is Medtronix Physio Control going to be putting out new AEDs or upgrades anytime soon? Basically, if you're not familiar, they received a notice from the FDA that there were some issues with some of their production techniques and manufacturing, and they were asked to, they volunteered to stop producing and making any upgrades until that issue could be resolved. Now, you know, I've heard that story from both sides. They were asked to do it, and they did it voluntarily. I don't know which side of that story you want to believe, depending on who you hear it from. But the long and the short of it is that they've kind of been out of production for about 6 months now, and it's causing some issues for anybody that's trying to upgrade equipment to the new standards or purchase new equipment and want to maintain some continuity in the use of 12-lead and field EKG machines or heart monitors. So what I would say is I haven't heard anything. To be honest with you, my agency is waiting for upgrades as well, and you know, I'm kind of getting impatient with the situation because I would really like to be in compliance with the current Heart Association protocols. So what do you do if you run into an AED that is programmed under the old system? And what do you do if you teach CPR to people that operate under the old system and you use an AED trainer that teaches the new system? I will tell you how Maryland handles it. You need to check with your own training and protocol officers on how they should be handling this. And check with your local, if you're an instructor, you need to check with your local training center. But I'll tell you how I've been handling it when I teach CPR and how I've been handling the situation when I come across AEDs and teach about AEDs. And this is, you know, this is something you need to check on your own, but this is how I would suggest looking at it, at least in the beginning. First of all, the protocol here in Maryland is that if you're a BLS provider, you use the AED as it was intended to be used with whatever programming it has. So if the AED wants to give 3 stack shocks, you give 3 stack shocks. If the AED is programmed for the new system and is giving biphasic shocks, single biphasic shocks followed by immediate CPR, then you're going to go ahead and follow that. So that's my recommendation when you are coming across an AED in the field. If your current AEDs are not trained or not upgraded to the new system and still operating under the old programming, then you follow the AED, because as a BLS provider, you are relying on the ALS intervention of that AED, and you should be letting the AED make that decision. That's not your problem. That's whoever the medical director is for your service and the equipment person for the AED that needs to be in charge of handling that situation. As far as training people for CPR, when I teach CPR classes, and every class I teach, I use an AED to train people. One of the things that I tell them is that when they come upon an AED, follow the AED's instructions. And it's basically the same thing I just told you. So I would, if you're using an AED trainer that is under the new system, I would like to think that you're mentioning that there are AEDs still programmed to the old system out there and that you should follow the AED protocol of the machine you're using. Now, if your local service is doing something different, that's why I caution you. Check with your protocol training officer. Check with your medical director. But that is the protocol here in Maryland officially. Until all the AEDs are upgraded, you are to follow the AED's instructions, whether it's so that you don't get confused. You follow what the AED tells you to do. So, Woody, I hope that answers your question. And check back here in the next week, week and a half, and I'll have something up on the site for cardiac rhythm websites to help you practice. Well, I'm going to move right on into this week's news. And before I do, I just want to apologize. If you've noticed, my voice is a little hoarse and cracking every now and then. I apologize. Put up with it. I had a good time with the family this weekend, laughing and carrying on. And I just got a little hoarse in the process. So, and by little hoarse, I don't mean miniature hoarse, of course. Anyway, enough of that. The first item in this news is really no laughing matter. The first item has to do with a physician that was charged with four counts of murder related to four seriously ill patients that died in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And she was charged with providing them a lethal cocktail at Memorial Medical Center following the storm because these patients were too ill to be moved. And she, the doctor basically said she did not kill anybody. She denied this. Lawyers said that the doctor and the two nurses involved in this trial were providing heroic actions. They did everything they could to keep these patients alive, and they did not have any history of doing anything other than providing excellent care. So this doctor has been acquitted of all charges by the grand jury. Following testimony, the two nurses were given immunity for their testimony to the grand jury. And basically, I think their testimony to the grand jury basically told the grand jury that the doctor didn't do anything wrong either. You know, this was a terrible situation. Anybody that remembers 2005 in August of that year, the horrible things that were going on in the aftermath of that hurricane. I mean, should we now charge the EMS personnel and the dispatchers with manslaughter because they had to make decisions on where to send crews and some people died and some people lived? I mean, you know, we could not get medical care down there fast enough. There was no power. There were no drugs. There was no resupply for an extended period of time. And doctors were making do with 18th century and 19th century medical techniques. They were back in the middle of the Civil War considering amputation because they didn't have the wherewithal to provide the advanced vascular grafts that were needed for severe limb injuries. I mean, come on now. And this brings to mind something that I shot a little email off to Rick Rosati over at the Mitigation Journal podcast, and I'm hoping that he addresses this in a future issue. Hint, hint, Rick. The question I have is, if we encounter a mass casualty situation or we're involved in any kind of major disaster where care is going to be delayed for hours or days or even weeks, where is our liability when we have to make hard triage decisions? Where is our liability when we have to make the decision to withhold life-saving medication from one patient because we need to have it available in smaller doses for others? Or we have to make a decision to withhold food or shelter or something else from somebody that's seriously ill because we can't provide enough for everybody. I mean, I know these are extreme situations and extreme decisions, but guess what? That's what disaster means. Disaster means that you're put in a position where you have to make the call of, I can only hold one more person in this boat, and five people are trying to get in, and you're going to have to kick four of them in the face and leave them to drown in order to keep the 20 people you have in your boat alive. Now, that's a tough decision. Are you prepared to make that call? And when you do, are you going to get hauled into court for 2 years to defend your actions that you saved 20 lives and four people died? That's something I don't want to see anybody put in as far as the situation. But I wonder what the liability and the legal ramifications are for any of us that might be pulled into a situation like that. So I'm interested to hear some other responses to this. If you want to, send me an email, call me on the voicemail line, and let me know exactly what you think and what your procedures might be for a situation like this. So, speaking of disaster preparedness, you know, one of the things that came out of the 9/11 Commission report was that there was inadequate communications between the fire and EMS services and the Port Authority and all of the other agencies involved in the rescues at the World Trade Center, and that was one of the reasons so many rescuers died, because they couldn't communicate effectively with each other about the situation in the buildings and in the area around. And so this caused a lot of outcry about upgrading the systems out there and who was going to get new radio systems. My area has since gotten a new radio system installed. There's a lot of complaining and grumbling about it, but you know, the system we had before had three channels, and if you had more than three emergencies going on in the entire county, you were talking over top of each other and no one could hear anything. So now we have a system that's very sophisticated, that has many different channel capabilities, that has local talk around capability, and really gives us a dimension of local control coupled with control through dispatch that we never had before. And so I want to just point out to people, as I found a story on one agency in Cumberland County, I believe Pennsylvania, that got a new EMS and police and fire radio system that all links together now. I want to point out that you need to check with your local agencies and check with your states and check with your federal grant process, because there is money out there to get this in place. This is a mandate of the 9/11 report that came out, that improved communication between first responders was paramount in providing better response to any future disasters or acts of terrorism. So I guess this is the disaster day, at least so far in the news, but it's something you might want to stay on top of and be aware of the process and what's available to you. Moving along to the next item in the news, I found an interesting study that came out of the journal Critical Care that discusses hospital staffing issues and a concurrent relationship to hospital-based infections. And while we don't work in the hospital in general, I certainly think that it points to the need for adequate medical staffing in any situation provides for better overall health outcome from the patients. And this should be obvious and make a whole lot of sense to people, but it points out that in the study, they looked at the fact that when fewer nurses were on duty in a critical care unit over a period of time, that patients were more likely to develop an infection within 6 days of the low staffing period, rather than when there were higher staffing of nurses and other caregivers, that there was fewer incidences of pneumonia and other infections. And this just makes sense. And I bring it up in relation to the earlier story about the lack of staffing, respect, I guess, lack of pay that concurrent with our skills, and really the bottom dollar way that EMS has looked at in the communities that we serve, that, well, we're just ambulance drivers and we aren't really providing care that makes a difference. We just are taking people to the hospital. And I know that there's not everybody feels that way, but I think there's enough people that still think that way, that is one of the reasons we don't get some of the respect that we deserve. And this study is one that you can point to that says, look, medical staffing is equal to the amount of healthcare and health outcome that people have. If you have better staffing, if you're willing to pay for one additional nurse on a shift, you're going to have an increase in the positive outcomes in that unit for that shift. So we need to start looking at doing studies like this in our field. There's a lot of funding out there and a lot of organizations that back up nurses and other inter-facility and in-facility professions, but we need to start looking at providing studies on things like this for our field. What is the relationship to ALS and BLS providers on outcome? Is it better to have two paramedics on a unit or a paramedic and an EMT? Is it better to do dispatch where you dispatch a mixed unit or you dispatch specific to the type of call? And we need to get these things out there and publicize them and let people know that our staffing is important, and that when we have an extra ambulance on in a given geographic region than we normally would, that ambulance is able to be better able to provide care for communities. We hear all the time people complaining that, oh, we had a second new unit respond to a cardiac arrest because we had no ambulances available and it took 15 minutes to get there. Well, how much cheaper? We now have a person who's dead. He's never going to pay taxes again. And what happened? You know, for the want of paying somebody's salary for a year, we ended up not having enough care providers in the field to save someone's life who might be worth $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000 in taxes down the road. And so I feel very strongly about this, I guess you can tell. But I just think that maybe we need to start looking at doing some kind of study on the efficacy of the care we provide based on the staffing that we're allowed to get out there on the road. Okay, I'm going to wrap up the news here today with a story about blood clots. And it comes from the Archives of Internal Medicine issue from July 23rd. And it's a study that looked at when blood clots occurred. Now, I'm talking about deep venous thromboembolism, DVT, or pulmonary embolism, also maybe known and referred to as PE. And what was found in this study was that most of these instances of blood clots occurring actually happened more frequently soon after discharge from the hospital. And this is because hospitals now are very aware of the causes of blood clots occurring. The long immobility of being confined to a hospital bed, recent surgeries, people are in the hospital for things like broken hips and broken bones, and When we have long bone fractures, we're more likely to kick loose a fatty embolism. And all of these things lead to increased risk. But in the hospital setting, people wear the compression leggings and have hospital beds that have variable settings to their firmness so that they pump up and pump down throughout the day, creating kind of a rolling effect, and the combined with the compression leggings, they actually massage the tissues and keep blood clots from forming by being immobile. Nurses are very aware of these type of things now and make sure that they get patients up and moving very quickly following surgery, because all of these things keep blood clots from happening. However, when they go home, they don't have these things provided for them. They often don't have a caregiver that's there to help them get up or down. And so in the months, weeks, and up to a year even after surgery, blood clots are more likely to form. In fact, what the study found was that among the patients in the study, which was nearly 2,000 patients of showing some form of blood clot, that 73.7% of them got the clot after leaving a hospital stay. Among these, 23% had undergone surgery, and 36.8% had been hospitalized in the past 3 months. Now, what this means is that patients who developed clots, 67% of them had a condition that was associated with a blood clot within 1 month of their hospitalization. So what does this mean for us? Well, first of all, we need to educate ourselves about things like DVT and pulmonary embolism. And I'll be talking about pulmonary embolism in a little bit here when I cover the tip of the week. But it also means that we need to be aware of medical history, making sure we take a good medical history so that we can understand maybe some obscure symptoms like diffuse leg pain or possibly chest pain that maybe moves in location and changes in severity. Chest pain associated with shortness of breath, but only localized to, like, say, the right side instead of the left side. Now, we might think this is a cardiac situation when, in fact, it might be a mismatch between ventilation and perfusion, that perfusion-ventilation mismatch we hear about when we look at things going on in the chest cavity. So we need to educate ourselves so that we can treat these things like the emergencies they are. Yeah, a DVT, you know, somebody with a leg that's swollen and warm, maybe doesn't seem all that severe to us. But if we're not gentle in the way we handle them, we could knock part of that clot loose, send it up into their lungs or into their brain. And now we're dealing with a stroke or a pulmonary embolism with a fatal heart attack, cardiac arrest going on. So again, this is something we need to pay attention to, and it starts with taking a good history. Okay, so this leads me right on into this week's tip and trick of the week. And I'm going to be looking at pulmonary embolism. And first of all, I want you to head on over and check out the link that I have in the show notes. There is a great link to information there from the National Institutes of Health. It's from the National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute that is part of the National Institutes of Health. And there's a great site over there that describes pulmonary embolism in good detail, talks about causes, who's at risk, signs and symptoms. That's where I get a lot of the information I'm going to be discussing with you today. But it's a great resource that you can head back to and refresh your memory when you get on down the road sometime and want to get back and take a look at what's going on with this issue. In 9 out of 10 cases, pulmonary embolism begins as a blood clot in the deep veins of the leg. And this is, of course, what we know as DVT, or deep vein thrombosis. The clot then breaks free from that vein in the leg, travels through the bloodstream to the lungs, where it becomes blocked in an artery. The pulmonary arteries lead from the heart to the lungs, carrying deoxygenated blood. And if it lodges in a large enough branch of the pulmonary artery, it can block blood flow to the sections of the lungs or an entire lung and cause that space to suddenly not be able to perfuse anymore. There's no blood moving through it. The lung, you're breathing fine, but you're not able to transfer any gas into that location. And so therefore, we have that ventilation-perfusion mismatch. We're able to ventilate, but we're not getting any response. We're not exchanging gas, at least in that portion of the lung or in all of the lungs in the case of a pulmonary embolism that blocks a significant portion of the lungs. So when this happens, you need to really be proactive in dealing with this with the patient. So who's at risk? Well, as I said earlier, patients that are recently hospitalized are at higher risk. And this is going to be something new that's come out in this most recent study. And you won't find that particular piece of information over at this website. But you will find other risk factors. And while PE occurs equally in men and women, there is an increased risk with age that will start to show up after age 60. Also, some people have a higher genetic risk. There's also anybody who's had a prior deep vein thrombosis or a history of other types of blood clots is at higher risk for PE. Anyone who's had a prior PE, of course, is at higher risk. Also, women who use birth control pills or take hormone therapy are at high risk. Anyone recently after pregnancy, after a recent long trip or prolonged periods of sitting or lying down, and within the 6 weeks after pregnancy, and anyone who's overweight or obese. And of course, anybody that has multiple numbers of these risk factors will be at higher risk. What you're going to find as far as signs and symptoms for pulmonary embolism are unexplained shortness of breath, unexplained breathing difficulty of any kind, chest pain, coughing. They may actually be coughing up blood, and what this is that they have backing up of fluid in their lungs, and it could come out as pink or frothy. They could also have some kind of an arrhythmia that may be an indication that they have a PE going on. Again, the heart starting to show signs of shock and trying to compensate for the reduced oxygenation of the blood that it's pumping. Sometimes you may only have some kind of related history symptom. And that's why I say it's important to really get a good history on every patient, because somebody with a recent surgery, a recent long trip, anybody that is recently pregnant, recently hospitalized, all these things can lead you to think that they've had maybe a recent DVT and therefore may have developed a pulmonary embolism as a result. So ask them questions about, do they have they had a recent spell where they had some redness or increased warmth in their leg? This might be an indication of DVT. Do an examination of their lower extremities to see if there's any signs of DVT there ongoing. Sometimes, especially in patients that are obese or diabetic, they may not be aware of their lower extremities, either because of neuropathy, where they just aren't possessing the feeling down there anymore, or they just, you know, unfortunately, in obese patients, they don't really know, they can't see their legs well enough to examine themselves as well as they probably would otherwise. If you do have something like this crop up, you want to advise your emergency room that of your suspicions and treat this as a true emergency. You may also occasionally, as a sign and symptom, patients will really have that feeling of severe anxiety and feeling that they're going to die or great fear or dread. And, you know, this is one of those situations when somebody is that scared and it just doesn't seem to match up. Sometimes you have to think that they know a little bit better what's going on for whatever reason than you do. The only good treatment for DVT and PE is going to be a administration of blood clot thinners. The goal is going to be to stop the clot from getting any larger, keep new clots from forming, and break up the clot that's there. So anticoagulants and thrombolytics are indicated in this case. Of course, we don't always carry these things on our units, and if we do carry them, they may not be indicated for an undiagnosed PE. In other words, we can't diagnose a PE definitively in the field, so it may not be indicated to give this for these patients. You'll have to follow your own protocols in that situation. But, you know, they're going to be looking for former signs of DVT when you get to the hospital. They're going to be doing things like ultrasounds to look for blood clots. They're going to be looking and performing CT scans. They're going to be doing ventilation perfusion scans on the lungs to see if you're adequately exchanging blood gas. And so all these things are going to be used to try to diagnose that it is indeed a PE. But this is a life-threatening emergency, and the hospital may be more proactive than others depending on their experiences. So the best thing, of course, to do with pulmonary embolism is to provide prevention. And that's one of the things that this hospital study that I talked about in the news dealt with. And it basically said that hospitals should be more proactive in providing medications both in the hospital and out of the hospital to patients to prevent the formation of blood clots. And furthermore, needed to better educate patients about the dangers of blood clots and how they are formed. Things like, if you're going to be on a long trip, set a little timer or alarm clock on your watch or whatever that alerts you to get up and move around periodically during the trip, so you're not sitting down for extended periods of times without moving around. If you are in a place where you have to sit for a long period of time, move and exercise your leg muscles during long car trips or airplane rides. Get out of bed, move around soon as you can if you've been ill for a long time at home or if you've had recent surgeries and have been sent home from the hospital. The sooner you move around, the lower chance you're going to have to develop a clot. Pass this information along to your patients. Those of you that are interfacility transport providers, you can pass some of this information along when you're taking patients home from the hospital if you're doing some kind of a transport home situation. You can also make sure you take medicines that you have prescribed after recent surgeries or after recent hospitalizations, and follow up as indicated with physicians. So again, these are all things that can be done, and there are home care situations that can provide additional support for people that are at risk for blood clot formation. All these things need to be kept in the back of your mind as an EMS provider when you're coming upon a patient that has pulmonary embolism. And really, the best thing is to prevent it, but the next best thing is to recognize pulmonary embolism for what it is, treat it as a true emergency, And unfortunately, the most definitive treatment is likely to be found only at the hospital. So rapid diagnosis, assessment, and transport is indicated. Okay, so we'll move right from that into this week's Med of the Week. And this week I'm going to look at Coumadin or warfarin. And this is a blood thinner or anticoagulant. And there are two primary anticoagulants used in the hospital setting to treat patients post-surgically. And these are heparin and warfarin or Coumadin. Heparin is given by IV or by IM injection. It works on one part of the clotting process, and it's a rapid-acting blood clot preventer. So you give it several times over the course of a day. You check your blood level. You check your levels through blood tests to make sure that you're not giving too much, and you maintain your levels of blood thinner in order to prevent the formation of blood clots at an optimal level. We're unlikely to see heparin in the field unless the patient's under some kind of professional long-term medical care at home. But we are more likely to see Coumadin or warfarin, which is given by mouth and operates on another portion of the clot formation chain. And this takes a little bit longer to put into place. And so patients are usually given Coumadin or warfarin right before they get ready to go home from the hospital, and it takes a little longer to start acting. So they start them concurrently and then get rid of using the heparin in favor of using the Coumadin when they get home. So Coumadin is, as I said, is an anticoagulant. It's different from a thrombolytic because we're going to try to prevent the formation of blood clots using this drug, but it will not break up an existing blood clot that's already in place. So it's used to prevent DVT and, of course, the formation of PE. It's given by mouth as a tablet, usually taken once a day. So when you encounter patients that are taking warfarin, one of the things you need to be aware of is that they're going to be prone to bleeding. They're going to have more bruising than might be ordinarily seen. Their bruises are going to take longer to heal. If they do have a cut or something like that, you may have trouble controlling the bleeding more than what you might expect from the size of the injury. And so this is something you need to keep in the back of your mind and get a good history on patients in trauma situations, because an elderly person who's taking Coumadin who has a relatively minor injury, even if they had a minor, let's say, internal bleed that on a younger person without Coumadin would probably heal over on itself without any evidence of any internal bleeding, an older person taking Coumadin is going to actually have a dangerous internal bleed going on because it won't clot as well on its own, especially if this patient is for some reason taking too much of their medication, maybe forgot they took it and over the last couple of days has doubled up on their dose for some reason. So you need to keep an eye on this when you're getting your histories, especially in trauma situations. Keep it in the back of your mind. It's also going to have an impact on your IVs. When you start an IV on a patient that's taking a blood thinner, you want to be aware that you're going to have to probably provide some kind of a pressure bandage on an IV that fails to start successfully. You know, if you puncture through the vein and blow your line for whatever reason, be prepared for nasty, quickly rising bruise and be prepared to provide some pressure on that area for some time in order to prevent the formation of a larger bruise than's going to happen anyway. So what do we need to be aware of? Again, these patients are at higher risk for uncontrolled bleeding. They, especially in the elderly, we need to be aware that they may have taken more than they're supposed to take. And I'm not saying this to stereotype, but when we're worried about underlying problems, the only way to find out what the blood levels are of this drug is to get a blood test. And that will be done at the hospital as soon as the doctor is aware that they're taking this medication. But we need to be aware that this is a possibility. The other thing is that this is a blood thinner, and it will duplicate or add on to the effects of other blood thinners. Also, antibiotics may have some additive effects. Aspirin, naproxen, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen, nutritional supplements that you might find at a health food store. Some of the, I guess, going native, you know, some of the home remedies that people might find from their cultural healer, often these include blood thinners in them. And so you want to be aware if they're taking anything out of the ordinary. Ask them, are you taking anything besides prescribed medications? Do you take any kind of home remedies? These are all important things to know if you have a patient that's taking heparin and you suspect they're having some kind of a bleed. They're also at higher risk if they're pregnant or may become pregnant. There may be people that are taking Coumadin and have become pregnant since then. And again, they're at increased risk for uncontrolled bleeding. And because of the increased vascularization of the placenta and increased blood volume, all of these things can cause issues. So you want to check out these kind of things and get a good history on the patient so that you're aware of other side effects that may have. Side effects that you may find with warfarin specifically are gassiness, which may be an indication of a GI bleed, unexplained tiredness, again, a sign of anemia, and pale skin, also a sign of anemia. Of course, anything that would be indicative of an allergic reaction could be seen in any medication and should be reported and identified. Things like hives, itchy rash, difficulty breathing or swallowing, as well as unexplained fever or infection, all may be signs of some kind of reaction to this medication. Warfarin can also cause tissue necrosis. And this is something that you need to be aware of if you have reduced circulation to your extremities, because you can have a bruise that doesn't heal. That bruise, if it doesn't heal long enough, can cause localized tissue necrosis and gangrene at that location. So we need to monitor any large bruises that have been there for an extended period of time to make sure that even though they've been there a while, they are indeed healing. What do you want to look for if you have a patient that you suspect may have taken too much of their Coumadin? Obviously, blood or other signs of GI bleed in the bowel movements or coffee grounds, vomiting, spitting or coughing up blood, heavy bleeding, unusually heavy bleeding concurrent with a menstrual period, blood in the urine. You may see unusual bruising or oozing or bleeding from relatively minor cuts. Now, we should see some increased bleeding, but if this patient's covered with Band-Aids that are all oozing blood, this is an indication that maybe their blood levels are way too high. In any case, you can just be aware of just generalized internal and external bleeding precautions with any patient that's taking Coumadin. And again, the generic name of that is warfarin. So just a little education on this particular medication, something that we are likely to see in the field, and it just helps for us to be a little bit more aware about it. And this is what would be a likely treatment that a patient would go home from the hospital on if they were concerned about them developing blood clots. So that's it for the Med of the Week this week. And that is going to wrap up this week's episode of the Medicast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show and sticking with us here through thick and thin. If you have any comments, you want to make sure you send them in to me. I have both an email access and, of course, a Medicast voicemail line. So you can contact me that way at podmedic@mac.com by email or at the voicemail line 941-306-3342, 941-306-3342, 941-306-3342, 941-306-3342, 941-306-3342, 941-306-3342, 941-306-3342, 941-306-3342, 941-306-3342, 941-306-3342, 941-306-3342, 941-306-3342, 941-306-3342, 941-306-3342, 30 medic. You can also always leave comments on any of the postings over at the Medicast blog over at medicast.com. Check out during the midweek. Check out the show notes. Check out all the other blog posts I put up. When I find news articles, studies that have been posted, or just have some information I want to share with you, I'll be putting that up midweek, as well as another new episode of the Medicast News midweek, which has news items, maybe four news items, lasting about 5 or 6 minutes to catch you up on things that might fall through the cracks during the week. And you can find information on that over at the website as well, or go directly to medicastnews.com, which is the link directly to that page over at the Podcaster News Network, where I host that show. Okay, time to close up the show, and I'll do that as I usually do with some great PodSafe music. This week, again, from the PodSafe Music Network over at music.podshow.com. Lots of great PodSafe independent artists over there that you can check out, contact, and there's ways to purchase their songs and music over there. Just a great resource for anybody that's interested in independent music. This week, I'll be featuring an artist by the name of Carlina. And she sings a song called How Long Will You Be Gone? And, you know, this is kind of, I think, a good song for us. A lot of us spend a lot of times away from our family when we are out on the street working multiple jobs to make ends meet and doing what we love in EMS. And How Long Will You Be Gone is something I think a lot of our loved ones think about. So I'll send you off with this particular song, and I guess I'll wrap up by saying, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, scene safety, BSI.
Every time you go away, I miss you a little more. My world distills, my heart it fills, I get emotional, I want more. I can try and be detached about it, pretend I don't miss the part of me you took. When you're back I can get my fix, but then the deeper in goes the hook. And I can feel myself fighting that left behind feeling as I look towards the sun. How long will you be gone? So come on, take me dancing, baby. Dance with me tonight. Give me a night to remember. Give me something worth the fight. Humor me, let me pretend it all in the end. Will I ever know your angels? Will they ever know my name? And I can feel myself fighting that left behind feeling as I look towards the sun. I've realized the time has come. I gotta let this ship set sail. Feel myself fighting.